Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I am Simone Tagliapietra.
And I'm Georg Zachmann.
And today we will discuss the energy crisis in Europe. Joining our conversation is Agata Loscott-Strakota, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Eastern Studies focusing on energy policy. Hello, Agata. How are you?
Hello. Good morning. Well, I'm fine, and thank you for having me here today.
Thanks to you for joining us. You're based in Warsaw, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes, I am based in Warsaw, and I work, as you said, for Center for Eastern Studies, which is a governmental think tank in Poland.
Great. And we want to go really straight to the core of the issue we are discussing today. The average European household faces electricity and gas bills 25% higher between December 2020 and December 2021, according to Eurostat. So that's pretty tough situation for many people across the continent. And the crisis is quite multifaceted. It seems almost that Europe has entered it without being completely aware of, like awakening all of a sudden in a bad dream, which might compromise some of the ambition on strategic autonomy, decarbonization, peace and security. What we want to understand and what we want to provide our listeners today is first and foremost an overview about how did we got where we are with this energy crisis, in Europe especially. I don't know if you would like to kick off this explanation, Agata, for our listeners.
Energy price hikes, gas price hikes, last year and this year were unprecedented. At the beginning, there were multiple factors. There are still multiple factors. Post-pandemic economic recovery, some say quicker than expected and stronger. Growing demand for energy. We see that especially clearly on the gas market. And we see there also limited supply. That was since summer last year, we see decreasing internal production, but also LNG flowing mostly to Asia, and also limited flows from Russia. And in addition to that, we saw gas storage sites in Europe, which haven't been filled sufficiently. Actually, they were at record low levels. And it was especially visible when it comes to storage sites which are controlled or associated with Gazprom in Europe. So we had low production, low LNG inflow, plus low storage filling levels. All that down in the second half of last year, and all that usually constitutes in the gas market some sort of a cushion, a flexibility provider in times of increased demand. So this was low, and that was a factor which influenced the market, but it also fueled uncertainty. An additional important factor here, which I think significantly influenced the situation in the European gas market and fueled uncertainty, was Russian on Gazprom's behavior. So behavior of the biggest supplier to European gas market, which was fulfilling and it's still fulfilling its all contractual commitments, but it stopped selling gas on spot market via exchange. It stopped booking additional capacity in pipelines and it did not fill sufficiently its storage site in Europe. So Gazprom did not seem to react to growing demand in Europe or to price signals and acted differently than other market players, but also differently than it used to act in previous years. So that fueled uncertainty. And additionally, right now we have increasing risks related to possible Russian invasion of Ukraine, increased tensions between Russia and the West, including on Nord Stream 2, and all that influences market, especially when it happens in autumn, in heating period, it translates into record high price and record volatility, especially on liberalized European market.
Georg and Simone, it almost looked at the beginning of the story that Agata told us back in the summer or early fall, that this was almost like a contingency moment, that this was not a long-term crisis, but it was like something that was exceptional in nature and we would have overcome after a few months. But the geopolitics side, Agata mentioned it already, but the situation seems to be a bit more serious and systemic than just a contingency. You have been analyzing this very, very thoroughly at Bruegel, so perhaps you can add on the picture that we just heard to understand what there is around the gas story, which needs to be taken into consideration.
You know, I can only underline what Agata has said, that at the beginning, we had largely a situation of a tightening demand-supply balance in Europe, and it looked quite a natural thing to see in a recovery. And the expected reaction would have been that more gas supplies would have been made available to Europe, but because of the tight global market, and then the very unusual behavior of Gazprom, this situation did not resolve, but got worse. So we, since the summer, essentially see that that flows from Gazprom through important pipeline routes into Europe have been decreasing. The pipeline through Poland and Belarus has been emptied almost, which is largely unprecedented, especially in a situation where we don't have an open conflict on anything here. And the pipelines through Ukraine has also been reduced quite substantially in throughput. So my assessment of the situation was that the global market dynamics and the demand and supply dynamics in the European market essentially gave leverage to Russia to become again a pivotal player on the European gas market. It essentially made it necessary to get some Russian gas into Europe, otherwise the demand-supply balance would not have been met. And that allowed, essentially, Russia to play with either the spot markets in Europe. So one might argue that it is of interest to Gazprom to do so, because a lot of their long-term contracts, which constitute most of their sales, are connected to the spot market prices. So if you manage to reduce volumes into the European gas market, you drive up spot prices and you earn a lot of money because your long-term contracts are linked to these spot prices. So that might be a commercial motive. But you might also think of the question of the certification of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and the very clearly stressed argument by Gazprom that the pipeline is really ready to go, that they filled in gas there and that they just... If we snip with the fingers and allow it, they are going to use it to deliver more gas and relieve our situation. On top of that comes the geopolitical situation, which have become more tense in the last days. We'll see what is going to happen here.
Simone, would you like to add something to this picture?
Yeah, I fully agree with what has been said. And I remember we were at the Bruegel annual meetings in early September with Georg discussing also this situation of the energy prices with our guest at the time in the energy panel. And that really looked like a problem of Spain, of certain limited number of countries. The European Commission and many in Europe were on the dismissal, saying this is going to be a very temporary situation, everything will be back to normal. And it's really impressive to look back at the last months and see how things escalated. And indeed, it started with this issue of the Nord Stream 2 certification. Then it became clearer and clearer that probably there were other drivers behind the Russian decision not to send additional volumes on the spot market. This idea of showing to Europe how important Russian gas is in Europe, probably showing that long-term contracts might be useful. So pushing Europe to rethink about the market structure we have pursued over the last decade. But really, I think also showing the role of gas in the European energy system and probably also trying to give signals about the viability of Europe decarbonization process. So I think there are a number of factors in here. And I think that so far we have manage the situation at a high cost, of course, because we all know what is the impact, and you have mentioned it at the beginning about of this situation on gas, on the energy bills of families and businesses. So this comes at a high cost for Europe, but we still don't have a supply issue, so a physical supply issue, and we have managed with US LNG and other sources to really fill this gap. And we also need to be thankful to the weather, because we have had a very mild winter so far, which is helping not to really accelerate the withdrawal in the storages that remain today at around 30%. So we are not in such a bad situation, so we can handle the winter probably pretty well. The problem would be, we have been looking into these contingency plans in the case Russia's stops all supplies to Europe. That is a systemic problem, which we might discuss now more for the medium term. And that would really require significant action by European countries and by the EU itself.
Indeed, and we are going to get back to this question in a second. But first of all, speaking about the weather, you mentioned that we are having a mild winter. And of course, we are all looking forward to an early spring. What are those scenarios, the short-term scenarios that we should look at, let's say, between now and the summer 2022?
So as Simone told, we were lucky, and we are lucky with the weather right now. Yes, it's unexpectedly warm, not only in Europe, but globally. And that means that additional LNG can flow. And as Simone also said, we managed to slow down withdrawal rates from storage sites, and that is good signal. Storage filling level, is close to the minimum of the 5-year average. It was much below that in last week, so that is something positive, which decreases a bit uncertainty and means that prices, well, let's say they stabilized a bit, so they are at the range of 70-90 euro per megawatt hour. And that happens, we don't see the hikes, as such hikes as in December when they were like 180, which is extraordinary. And all that happens despite still reduced Russian supplies, despite all this uncertainty related to Russia-Ukraine situation. That also, of course, influences the situation, but then it's much more stable. But it's worth remembering that when it comes to European gas market, it remains highly dependent on right now on at least two factors of uncertainty. And well, the weather is this factor. We don't know what will be the weather in next 2 weeks. And then the other is, and it didn't, and it wasn't in previous years, Russia's behavior. We don't know what Russia is going to do. And as Georg and as Simone said, yes, probably it aims at Nord Stream 2, it aims at maximizing profits, and it's signing long-term contracts, somehow locking in its gas in European energy mix. But if we think about possibility of Russia stopping supplies at all, that means that there must be also other considerations, other goals, because it is highly improbable in my opinion, but yeah, we cannot exclude that. So when it comes to scenarios, it seems that the storage size won't be depleted this winter, that we will enter spring and summertime without like contingency measures needed to be taken on EU gas market. With increased LNG availability, if it's sustained, it should calm down situation. But what we have to remember that the demand globally and in Europe will remain strong. In Europe, we'll need to replenish storage sites, which will be at record low levels. Additionally, there are these discussions about strategic gas reserves or storage obligations. All that will increase demand for gas in Europe. We have perspective of total phasing out of Groningen production in Netherlands. We expect closures of next nuclear power plants, which all means that there will be strong demand for gas imports. And that means that prices will remain high till summer. And next winter, we will enter with some question marks related to supply side, especially Russian behavior. And of course, we cannot still exclude the disruption of Russian gas supplies to Europe because of the tensions, because of we don't know what will happen with between Russia and Ukraine in the next weeks or months.
Going a little bit deeper into this Russian story, Georgia and Simone, you've been looking at contingency plans in case of a further reduction or, in the worst case scenario, a complete halt of Russian gas supplies to EU. Should this happen, could Europe replace Russian gas imports this winter and the next two winters? In other words, can Europe survive without Russian gas?
We started to do a couple of scenario analysis, and obviously with the means that we have available in terms of looking into production and alternative supplies and consumption and how it might develop. And in this simplified world, what we see is that for this winter, if you take Europe as an aggregate, I think we are through. So even if Russia stops today, there should be enough gas if we manage to deplete all European storages in a synchronized way so that not some country sits on its gas and doesn't give it to another country that needs it. So if we act in full solidarity, this winter, I think, is done. The question will be how much gas we will need for coming winter. And here, our preliminary analysis says, okay, if Russia continues to deliver at the relatively low level that they are delivering currently, and I mean, it's impressive. If you look into the numbers, normally Russia delivers twice as much as we get via LNG. Currently, it's the other way around. We get twice as much LNG than the Russians are delivering. So if we continue that situation and if we can sustain these high LNG imports, we would be able to have enough gas in storage for also getting through the next winter. But if Russia completely stops, then we need to resort to more dramatic measures to make sure that the demand-supply balance is upheld in Europe. And there are, of course, options there. We have so many ways in which we consume gas, and some of those ways in which we consume gas can be reduced. Agata spoke about the power sector, and of course, we can produce power not only from gas, but also from other technologies. And here, there is some flexibility. Just think of the German strategic reserves in terms of coal-fired power plants that are sitting there and could be utilized. But also in burning of oil in gas-fired power plants is a possibility. So there are a couple of very expensive and very crisis-type measures that can be used. My impression at that moment is that nobody wants to discuss that, and nobody probably should discuss that politically, because those measures are highly politicized. I mean, it's always... there are different member states that have different flexibilities, and every member state would rather like that the other member states use their flexibility and not that that the Germans force the Dutch to produce more gas in their gas fields and cause seismic activities, or the Italians ask the French to reduce their industrial production based on gas. I mean, there are all those ways in which we can reduce gas consumption in an orderly way, but these discussions need to happen between member states and need to happen across sectors, and they employ extremely difficult trade-offs. So therefore, we understand where those possibilities are. We know that without Russian gas, there will be a certain shortfall that has to be met from other sources and demand reduction. Of course, that can be managed, but the concrete discussion around that will be more a political discussion, and it will be a very big test on solidarity within the European Union.
And speaking about this political test and solidarity between the different member states, Simone, I would like to ask you which are the measures that you would recommend to take at European level?
Well, if I may, first of all, build up on what Georg just said, because in our analysis with Ben McWilliams and Giovanni Sgaravatti and Georg, we have shown that demand reduction in a case of a complete halt of Russian gas supplies, will have to happen, which means you need to ask factories to close down for a certain period of time. Over the last days, the European Central Bank has made an analysis showing that an hypothetical 10% gas rationing shock on the corporate sector would reduce the euro area gross value added by 0.7%. Of course, way higher numbers in the countries that are more dependent on Russian gas. this is only an hypothesis for 10% gas rationing shock on the corporate sector. So imagine that such a situation would be way larger, of course, right? So this would have massive implications for the European economy and really halt the ongoing recovery process. So I think this should be very crystal clear, and not to talk about the pricing impacts, because we already see today and companies across Europe closing down their productions because of the skyrocketing gas bills. So this is an extremely serious situation. Now, what can countries do? One thing is what Georg said. So basically not be egoist and ensure that if there is gas available in one country, that can flow to a neighboring country that is in need of the gas. So of course, this entails the difficult political decisions that Georg mentioned. Something that Europe certainly needs to reflect on of the last weeks and months is how to use our storage in a better manner. We have a problem in Europe that we have quite a significant storage capacity, but our regulation do not mandate the companies that own these storage sites to fill them up. So we might need to start asking and mandating these companies to fill up these storages in order to have a buffer to really manage potential supply shocks in the future. This could be a sort of insurance mechanism that Europe can adopt. In the past, with Georg, we have proposed also a wider insurance scheme for European gas supplies, entailing option contracts, for example, with LNG suppliers, so that we can get LNG in case of need, having these option contracts in place. So that could basically let the private sector to find the most efficient solutions to ensure security of supply. So to have a margin of security of supply always available in the market, also in terms of physical deliverability. And that could be something that we will need to consider, because this situation has once more stressed that while since 2014 and the energy union, etc., we have made important steps towards ensuring greater security of supply in Europe, we are still not there. We need to do more. And this, I think, was a very strong wake-up call for Europe to move in this direction.
Agata, what do you think about those measures proposed by Simone? But indeed, those are joint proposals, because Simone and Georg have been writing together about that.
I will just take a step back and go back to solidarity issues. I just wanted to make a small remark that will be a huge test for the EU, but also for EU relations with its Eastern Partnership countries. And I mean here, most of all, Ukraine and Moldova, which already have problems and which are already in a very difficult situation. So that will be wider than just EU problem. And that already is wider than EU problem. We see problems already in Balkan countries. You asked about these measures that could be recommended, and I, of course, agree that storage obligation is something that should be considered. We see that existing in several EU member states. In France, in Poland, there is storage obligation to keep 30-day equivalent of average imports by importers. But I understand that different things will be on the table. I hear that Germany is right now discussing that, and it is especially important for countries which holds huge storage site. Perhaps there should be some thinking put into a strategic reset at EU level, which should be, I don't know, to European Commission or some institution disposal in case of emergency, to stabilize situation in case of price hikes, like unprecedented and unbearable for countries. On the table, the comeback idea of joint purchases. I understand that it is no-go solution in Europe. Too many questions are asked to big opposition, but still there will be questions about supply, about new contracts, how to attract them, how to shape them, what about long-term deals, what about long-term deals with Russia, what about competition between different EU companies in case of scarcer supplies available. Perhaps we should also think about diversification threshold on EU level, that there should be some maximum, I don't know, level of supplies from one country. I don't talk about volumes, but about shares. And then perhaps we should think about partnership with key non-Russian gas suppliers to Europe. We see European Commission traveling a lot. We see this special cooperation with United States, but also von der Leyen, I read today, said that European Union talked to Azerbaijan, Qatar, Nigeria, Norway, but also big consumers like Japan and South Korea. So I understand that it could be, but I don't know if it will be translated into some concrete which could stabilize EU expectations related to what is available, what could be available in an emergency situation. But I also think that there will be also longer-term measures needed. I think that what is missing in Europe actually is bigger clarity about natural gas role in energy transition. It somehow hampers a bigger investment upstream worldwide, not only European questions about natural gas role in energy transition, but globally. In Europe, I think what is problematic is like that we fear that the unity can be broken. And one of the divisive problematic issues are EU relations with Russia, both short and longer term. And there are these questions about Nord Stream 2, about future long-term contracts with Gazprom, and role of European utilities in crisis situation. Questions about foreign or Russian ownership of strategic infrastructure and assets in Europe. And then questions about Russian role in European decarbonization process, cooperation in hydrogen, etc.
Georg, I guess that you want to have a short reaction to what Agata just said, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about adding two points. The one, kind of bringing a bit the picture together on these storage obligations. I mean, we currently have these discussions on a national level, and I see a risk that if we are in a tight situation and every country has a different storage obligation, they all will want to fill their storages first according to their obligation. And if they have then different incentive schemes in their countries, then they will outbid each other for who gets the gas into their storages, which might not be a very healthy competition between member states here. So finding a European solution, I think, is something that will also help to maintain unity in this very complicated situation. So I would actually even a bit wondering to which degree, for example, the existing storage obligations in some countries helped those countries now in the current crisis, but they actually meant that commercial companies did inject less gas in other storages in other European countries that didn't have these obligations. So therefore, if we have a common market, then we to some degree also need common rules. And a second point on preparation for the next winter, for me, the biggest challenge is that our market is built on commercial action of individual companies. But those companies are now confronted with two extremely unpredictable developments. One is, what is Russia going to do? And the other one is, what is policy going to do? And now there is a risk that commercial actors will sit on their hands because they are essentially worried that the market will be flooded with gas from Russia in summer at low cost, and they are essentially going to lose their shirt if they now buy too expensive, or that policymakers will open the pockets and give a lot of money to them if they do it in the right moment, but not if they do it before. So therefore, there is a risk that we discourage private companies from doing what they are supposed to do in this market. And we need to find a sort of firewall to help companies to essentially do their job here. It's tough because those companies have been partly responsible for the crisis, I would argue, that we are currently seeing. One of the kind of maybe more technical notes here is that there are European companies that have long-term contracts with Gazprom, and Gazprom is claiming that they are not requesting more gas from them, and that they would be able to buy more gas from them, and that they would be happy to deliver that. We cannot look into those contracts. We don't see what is actually happening here. But we need to get a better understanding also on the on our market actors' incentives to make sure that security of supply in the European market is maintained.
That's a very a good addition to the reflections we had so far. But I wanted to build up also because we are going to get closer to the end of the time which we have today. But one thing that Agata mentioned that we haven't touched that much because it's more of a longer-term issue, is how all this intersects with Europe's long-term climate ambition that will ultimately ensure secure energy supplies. So are we more vulnerable in this transition? I mean, in some member states, the discussion is really already quite out there, you know, at the public opinion level. This crisis arrives exactly in the moment where Europe in July 2021 launched the Fit for 55 package. Isn't there a risk that some of those measures are going to be withdrawn or watered down, or in general have this overall assessment that the transition will be more complex, costly than we thought? What is your take on this longer term challenge?
Yeah, thanks, Giuseppe. Sorry for imposing myself here. Because it's something I've been thinking a lot about, and I see essentially two big questions to be addressed here. One is around narratives. So what narrative are we going to get on the crisis? What stories are going to be told? Who is responsible for that? And that will shape policies. And that is then the second question, which policies will be drawn out here? It is not a natural development that from this crisis, something good or something bad for the decarbonization is going to happen. It's around the spinning of the narrative, and it's about how this narrative is then translated into policies. Now, going from the abstract to the more concrete, we are having one narrative that is saying that the emission trading system of the European Union is partly responsible for the problem because the prices in the emission trading system increased because of the recovery, because also of the high gas prices. And this very high carbon prices that we have not seen in the past is responsible for higher electricity prices. And it's not completely unlogical that the high electricity prices have something to do with the high carbon prices. The question now is, will we manage to defend the emission trading system and make it better in this process and keep it as a core instrument for European decarbonization? It's an instrument that has been built for more than 20 years, and there's a lot of institutional capital in there that has flown into that. And if we kill it, essentially, in my view, we can forget about decarbonization in Europe because we're not going to get an instrument as effective, as efficient, and as well negotiated between the different partners as the emission trading system. So my big plea will be keep the emission trading system intact, try to only improve those things that need to be improved, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The other element is more on the positive side. I mean, we talk about the role of gas in the decarbonization, and now the question is, we saw that there's a problem with fossil supplies to Europe. We understand that that countries that produce more electricity in low carbon ways domestically will have potentially less of a problem, and that if we have more renewables or more nuclear, if a country desires to have that in the system, then that essentially shields them against such outside shocks. So we see very high electricity prices, as I mentioned before. This should encourage more renewables and potentially more nuclear. So in that sense, the crisis could, if policymakers use that momentum, be a catalyzing point for speeding up the decarbonization in the power sector. And if you decarbonize the power sector, you will be able to also install heat pumps and essentially electrify the heating sector. And we might wean ourselves off faster from natural gas than we expected. Last point, in the European Union modeling for the 2030 targets, there is some modeling on gas demand in Europe. And the modeling on gas demand in Europe in these 2030 scenarios is already pointing downward. I think it's minus some 10 or so percent compared to 2020. So we are already on a decreasing trend of gas demand if you would follow what the Commission had underpinning their climate strategies. So we should use this momentum and hope that this helps us to prevent future crises and now go through the transition towards a world where we don't have any issues with gas supplies to the European Union anymore.
Agata, would you like to add something to this?
So I absolutely agree that current problems, and especially if there are bigger problems with Russian gas, will be a trigger to quicker and probably more effective transition to non-Russian energy sources. And I agree that there are these uncertainties when it comes to narratives and policy choices. But my worry is that as we are in a times of like great uncertainty, difficult economic situation, pandemics, inflation, food prices rising, and that people are tired with this uncertainty. Societies are tired. Politicians seek for quick fixes. And I think that may intensify that decentralized tendencies in Europe. That means that I don't know if we will have one narrative prevailing or we will have different narratives and different policy choices. And this would be worrying for me because it would somehow be a challenge for common policy, climate and energy in other spheres. So that is something that I worry. And of course, yes, European Green Deal, ETS, it is being blamed as everyone is searching for scapegoat and easy answers to current problems. And we see that in Central Europe quite clearly. But what I think also is that this crisis is a bit of a reality check to European Green Deal, as my feeling is that it was constructed in a difficult because of pandemic, but also convenient for European Commission times, because there was not that much consulting, not that much talking with European Parliament, with member states, because everyone was locked down. So it was perhaps less consulted. And because of that, like big shock, which came right now, will like clearly show what is feasible, which instruments can be used and what is political fiction. And it is important to have that, you know, well checked, because as for climate ambition of European Union, I understand that it's not only about all European member states being on board. It is about exporting that outside. And to get it exported, you know, we must show that it is, you know, acceptable and feasible for every member state, also for these poorer ones.
So you see an occasion for more buy-in and revision of the package, but also some more ownership by everyone.
Yes, indeed, I do see that. I don't know if revision of the package, but I mean, of certain specific instruments, how they are shaped, should they be implemented right now, or how much should we put energy into hydrogen strategy if we have an energy crisis right now, you know, in our house.
I see. And on this, I would like Simone to give us some final thoughts as well before we close.
Well, last year, we have been writing quite a lot about the need for a green social contract, right, Giuseppe at Bruegel. And the idea here is that the social dimension of decarbonization is a key element to ensure the long-term viability of the process. And we should be aware that particularly for populist parties, decarbonization can be the new migration topic. It's a perfect fit for their narratives. And we need to build this transition in a way that prevents these to really explode as a problem. So to solve this at the beginning. And I think that what Georg mentioned at the beginning, so for example, the limited role of the ETS in the electricity prices, I think that's exactly the reason why Ursula von der Leyen goes around in each European Council to show one chart, which shows the increase of the electricity price in Europe, showing that only 20% of that is due to the ETS, 80% is due to gas. To remember that this is a natural gas crisis, and decarbonization can only be a solution to lower our dependency on this fuel. This is important, but it's not always easy to explain this to people, particularly when they get the energy bill at home. And of course, they get worried and scared by this situation. I think that if we look back at history, at what we took out of the oil shocks, for example, I mean, we took out security measures. So Agata was mentioning the gas reserves. I mean, after the oil shocks, we created the International Energy Agency to have for all members 3 months of strategic petroleum reserves. So that is something that eventually we might develop for gas, as we discussed. But during the oil shocks, we have also started to invest significantly into the research that led to the solar energy, for example, we today have at a very competitive cost. So after an energy crisis, you also get investments into the alternatives, right? So I think we really need to work on this narrative here and really make sure people understand this is also a challenging situation in which we will need to accelerate the decarbonization process while managing the declining role of fossil fuels. So that is going to be challenging because we need also to give signals to producers about the schedule of our import requirements over the next years and decades. And I think facing this transition challenge and this need to manage the declining role of fossil fuels and namely natural gas in the European energy system could be an important lessons learned out of this situation.
Thank you, Simone, for those a lot of food for thoughts. We could actually keep discussing about those, but unfortunately, that's the time that we have for today. So I need to wrap it up, but we are definitely going to keep the conversation alive. Definitely, we have this conversation alive here at Bruegel, also with a series of events on the topic, and you can check on our website for all those analyses that we were mentioning, and some of them, I mean, we are going to make sure that they are going to be linked in the show notes. Having said that, I would like once again to thank Agata for joining us today, and of course Georg and Simone for their insights. And thanks obviously to all our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.